From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, how Wisconsinites turn out to be a pretty generous bunch.
Then the Wisconsin Policy Forum examines relatively non-controversial 2019 budgets at the city and county level in Milwaukee.
It's really a big contrast with this time last year when going into the 2018 budgets, there were needs for substantial cuts. And in the case of the county executive had proposed a $30 increase in the vehicle registration fee. But this year, very few fireworks.
Poet Andrea Gibson wishes more people would turn out at poetry readings.
We all go to see bands that we love, even if we're not musicians. So I always wondered, why aren't people who aren't writers coming to hear poetry?
Plus, writer Kim Sewer's new collection of short fiction and the Public Museum's focus on frogs.
Lake Effect is next, after this news.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This is the season of giving gifts, but it is not just gifts in a stocking or under a tree. It's also the season many people do their charitable giving. And a recent report shows Wisconsinites have been pretty generous when it comes to giving in recent days. The study by the Wisconsin Philanthropy Network shows people, foundations, and companies give almost $2.7 billion to charitable causes each year.
Tony Shields is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Philanthropy Network, and Katie Bulgren is the director of operations and research, and they join us in the studio now. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having
us.
What can you tell us about how Wisconsin, or whether Wisconsin, is in line with the rest of the country when it comes to trends in giving?
So Wisconsin is a very generous state, so we are definitely in line. This past year, 2017, our nation had the best charitable giving it's had. It had over $400 billion in giving, and Wisconsin definitely has followed suit in that.
Is there a double-edged sword to this that we're seeing more people with? I mean, is there something about the, you know, does this speak maybe to what we hear about the economic recovery, that there are some people that are very able to give and very eager to give, and at the same time, the need to give is that much greater?
So I think it is double-edged. I think that there is a desire. There's always been a desire in Wisconsin, even in economic downtimes. You look back to a decade when the country wasn't at a healthy state that it is, and now there was still a strong level of giving. In fact, at that time, giving went up. And so I think the 10-year trajectory of giving over the last decade suggests that Wisconsin is just a consistently good, giving, generous community of givers.
What do we know about why Wisconsin is such a strong giving state?
So part of it, I mean, you know, I think we're a very traditional Midwest, you know, think about your community kind of state. But just like nationally, the stock market did great in 2017. Anytime the stock market does great, everyone has a little bit more disposable income. And with the economic stability, I think people kind of were feeling, they're typically a little bit more generous with their philanthropy.
What do we know about, you know, when we're talking about giving, we're talking about nonprofit institutions that are the recipients of this giving. What are the various sectors and how are they doing in relation to each other?
So when we look at interest levels for our members, we do a surveying on a regular basis of our membership. You look at the top segments, the top areas of interest that are of interest to our members. Education continues to be at the top of the list. There's energy around workforce development. There's energy around racial equity and inclusion issues. Mental health and health in general are those areas that are really seeing a higher influx of giving and really taking advantage of and being able to bring that giving in.
What about in terms of the numbers of people who are giving?
What's really interesting is, and this comes out in our Wisconsin Gives report, is the sheer number of foundations that are in the community. We are upwardsly around 1,800 various foundations now. 66% of those foundations are operating under $1 million. But you do see a cluster of some of the larger foundations that of those 1,700, approximately $787 million in giving comes out of those organizations. But then when you look at a smaller fraction of around 100 to 150, those 150 actually comprise the about $600 million in giving. And so when you're looking and thinking about who are making a lot of the decisions around giving and what that potentially looks like, it's actually a really smaller group because many of the foundations that make those larger numbers are really smaller in scope type organizations.
You said there are obviously several, I think it was just over 100 sort of large foundations and large
Yes.
organizations that are responsible for a lot of giving. But what do we know about, you know, trends when it comes to individuals giving, you know, potentially smaller amounts of money, but significant ones nonetheless?
Well, one of the things that a Wisconsin Philanthropy Network is really striving to do is really create a culture of philanthropy statewide. And positioning philanthropy in the space of that everyone has the opportunity to be a philanthropist. Philanthropists in nature solve problems or problem solvers. So they look at an issue that's happening in the community and they make a decision that they want to put resources towards helping to solve that problem. And so this whole culture of philanthropy starts with every day, every person. So we really believe in the concept of everyday philanthropists, having people understand and see themselves as philanthropists in that space. And then there is legislation, federal legislation that is that is in the works, that's designed to help people set up flexible spending accounts, similar to healthcare accounts, that will allow people to become that will allow people to put pre-tax dollars towards their own charitable giving account. This is a great thing because this will allow everyone to think in the space of generosity, to think about the organizations and the issues that they're looking at, and give everyone in the state an opportunity to see themselves as people that are problem solvers through philanthropy and seeing themselves as philanthropists.
It's not just giving so you can get your name on a building.
That's exactly right. I love telling the story about the times where you may have a young person who, and I'm talking like a child, who may develop a lemonade stand. And mom says, you can keep half of your money for your games and toys and things you want to play with, but half of the money that you make, you need to give it to charity. And that young person is thinking about the environment, thinking about things that are happening in the world, and thinking about how they can source that. And that's really what everyday philanthropy looks like. It is that level of generosity for people all across the spectrum, all across the lifespan, all across income levels, thinking about how we can solve problems in our communities.
We hear a lot about the term collaborative giving. What are we talking about when we're talking about collaboration in this kind of sphere?
So it goes on both sides. So there's lots of funders out there who want nonprofits to work together for a common, like, social need. So some of them, you know, if you're going to apply for a grant, they really want you working with another nonprofit, possibly to address homelessness or gun violence, so that you're looking at multiple areas. But then also funders are working together to pool money in order to make a bigger impact on a particular area. So instead of giving, you know, each organization giving $5,000 to, you know, a couple different organizations, they're pooling it, maybe hopefully making a bigger impact on in a particular area.
Yeah, the philanthropic community, many of the foundations statewide are having these conversations about how we can really delve down into more collective impact. They're looking at issues that communities are facing, thinking about who's doing the work well, and then engaging in conversations around how they can pull their resources together to have a greater impact.
What about non-monetary giving? How do we measure, first of all, the impact of non-monetary giving, and also the trends in it, whether it's increasing as well?
Well, it seems a little bit rudimentary, but, you know, time is the greatest asset that anyone can contribute. You know, we're all busy people. We're all working on in particular areas, committing our time to work. And so the biggest and greatest non-monetary gift, and something that you're seeing with many of our corporate foundations, are these employee giving programs or employee time employee programs. They can be measured by number of hours that people are serving, number of people within organizations that are doing that work. And those are also the starting point for some of the great relationships that organizations are able to able to engage in with employees at a particular company. Once you get someone in the door and you can engage them in your work, you can build a longer, long-sustaining relationship that are very important for the sustainability of any organization.
Yeah, and a lot of our members, we did a survey of funders here in Wisconsin, and one of the things they said, they're going to start providing more non-monetary assistance, such as providing space for convenings, technical assistance, volunteer time, things like that, because those can be equally as impactful and save nonprofits some time and some money as well.
Are changes in tax policy impacting the incentives for giving at this point?
There's no way to know yet. So no one has filed their taxes yet for 2018. So that's really the waiting game. There is legislation out there and try to help counteract, I guess, some of the possible tax changes. So we will see when we all file our taxes next year and how that's going to impact our giving.
Sounds like another interview come April.
Yeah, it does sound like another interview come April. But I will say that it has, while we haven't been able to measure or see the impact or wake up and say this is around what's happening, we have engaged in a lot of conversations in 2018 around kind of teeing up what that could potentially look like and what that impact is. So there are a lot of people that are keeping an eye on this, rightfully so. And so, yeah, there will be opportunities for further discussion as we go forward. And it is an area of interest for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will talk again. Tony, Katie. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much, Mitch, for having us.
Tony Shields is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Philanthropy Network, and Katie Bulgren is director of operations and research. You'll find a link to the Wisconsin Gives report at WUWM.com.
Coming up, some of the key takeaways from both the City of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County budgets for the coming fiscal year. That's when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier this year, policymakers at the city and county levels debated the merits of proposed budgets for the coming fiscal year while weighing legislative priorities with fiscal responsibilities. Both budgets were passed with relatively few changes.
Each year, the Wisconsin Policy Forum scrutinizes these budgets and offers some analysis. This year is no exception.
What is an exception is the relatively non-controversial nature of these budgets. Rob Henkin is president of the forum, and he joined us in the studio earlier this year. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
So as we look at the budget briefs for both the city and the county, 2018 or really 2019 as we're looking at, seems like a relatively calm year for both.
Yes, really uncanny the way for both the city and the county, some very good fortune has made this a not so difficult budget year. And it's really a big contrast with this time last year when going into the 2018 budgets, there were needs for substantial cuts. And in the case of the county executive had proposed a $30 increase in the vehicle registration fee. But this year, very few fireworks.
Well, and so let's start with the county, which has seen all sorts of struggles over recent years. What is the good fortune that has led to the county being in the position that it's in right now, realizing that there are still some caveats?
Sure. So the good fortune is healthcare. We call it the gift that keeps on giving. The county has been able to generate some remarkable savings in its healthcare spending really over the past 5 or 6 years. We did a projection and adjusting for inflation, they should be spending about $40 million more per year today than they're currently spending if their healthcare costs from 2011 had simply increased with inflation. They have not. They've actually gone down. And every year the county makes a projection forecasting what you're going to spend for healthcare when you're a self-administered plan. It depends on utilization. It depends on lots of factors. You try to make your best guess. To cut to the crux of it, their guess was way too conservative for 18. They ended up saving about $10 million or will save by the end of the year. Consequently, their projection for 2019 healthcare spending doesn't go up at all. You have the inflationary increase, but it's a lower baseline. So the fact that they originally were thinking that was going to be about a $7 or $8 million cost, also their pension fund contribution is not going up in 19. Those are the two factors that usually combine to create a very difficult budget climate, and they're flat this year.
What do we know about why healthcare costs have not gone up to the degree that we would have expected?
I think if you ask county leaders themselves, they would say we don't know for sure. I think we can look at a few factors. Number one, the size of the county workforce has gone down. Number two, the county has made efforts in terms of wellness, in terms of incentivizing people to get care at the right place and not wait until they need emergency care and more expensive care. I think that we're simply seeing people perhaps a little healthier than had been forecast. So, but that can turn the other way on you too. And so that's why even as we look ahead to the 2019 budget, the county is being relatively conservative in its projection.
Well, and so let's talk about what the caveats are. And one of them, I gather, is what we were talking about not that long ago, which is the challenges in parks and cultural facilities. There's not a lot of aspirational spending that the county is doing.
That's correct. So we can say not a lot of fireworks, relatively calm budget year, but we can also look at the fact that there's about $13 or $14 million worth of essentially cuts that had to be absorbed in departmental budgets. They were able to do it without noticeably impacting services. But a few factors. Number one, you have the county continuing to use its reserves. They're dipping into their debt service reserve for $3.9 million. They're unlikely to be able to do that next year. You have the fact that health care and pension are again going to go up. And then you have, as you just said, we have this huge backlog of infrastructure repair needs, particularly within the Milwaukee County parks. And there's just real tension there between the county's need to take care of this infrastructure and its limitation on borrowing, where if it issues too much debt to take care of too many of its capital needs, then those debt service payments are going to start to crowd out other needs in future budgets.
You also write about a potentially unsustainable trend as far as transit goes.
Yes, the transit component of the budget continues to be a microcosm of the county budget itself, where the revenue streams simply are not expanding with inflation. The costs go up every year. In this case, it's not just the traditional costs of salaries and benefits, but also fuel. And so there's a hole in the transit system budget every year. There are a couple of one-time fixes that are used this year. Nonetheless, there are still some minor service reductions and minor fare increases. But here, too, going forward, it looks like there's going to have to be an increasing commitment of local dollars, either through the property tax or the wheel tax, to support current levels of service.
So potentially a year from now, we may be having a very different conversation about the 2020 Milwaukee County budget.
I think that's certainly on the horizon.
All right. So let's talk about the city of Milwaukee budget. And if there was good fortune in the county's budgeting plans, there is likewise good fortune that the city of Milwaukee has on its side.
Yes. And likewise, one time in nature. But here, remarkably, the city's pension fund actuary overestimated the amount of the city property tax levy employer contribution that would be needed in 2018 by a whopping $13.4 million.
That's a fairly significant overestimate.
Yes, it is. And certainly better to have an overestimate than an underestimate. So what that does is really twofold. Number one, we have the mayor proposing to take this $13.4 million savings from 2018 and sock it away in a pension reserve. Now, if you're an elected official, you're not really scoring points necessarily. You can't do a ribbon cutting to put $13 million into a pension reserve, but a very fiscally responsible move because this pension contribution is actually scheduled to go up rather significantly in the years ahead.
And we have talked about that.
Yep. One of certainly the key structural issues for the city. But this also produces a benefit for the 2019 budget because instead of budgeting the $83 million from 18, you can now budget $70 million in 2019 through a variety of reasons. That actually turns into about a $9 million savings. So what we are seeing essentially is that this $9 million is used to offset the cost of some of the city's traditional pressures, the salary and wage increases, and about a 2% healthcare increase, which is pretty good, but an increase nonetheless. That gets wiped out by this savings. What you have is largely a status quo budget. Now, for many jurisdictions, when you're talking a status quo budget, that's not necessarily good news. But given the very fierce structural pressures on the city of Milwaukee, budget, status quo in a given year is good news.
Well, and it sounds like if there is any sort of trend that we're talking about in the 2019 City of Milwaukee budget, it is how to be fiscally responsible with the savings that were encountered in 2018.
Yes. And clearly there's temptation. I mean, there's lots of need out there. We look at the health department as a prime example where we have seen some real issues in terms of not only management but in terms of resources. We can name a whole host of issues where city leaders ideally would like to be able to invest. Once again, this is an effort where we're not seeing a lot of new investment, even on the lead issue where the mayor is touting a $20 million investment in both lead poisoning programs in the health department and lead service line removal at the Milwaukee Water Works. That's all basically unspent federal grant money that is now going to be spent, not a whole lot of local money going in there. So that's good news for local taxpayers, but it's bad news because if you want to sustain that commitment in future budgets and those grants run out, then you're going to have to supplant it with local dollars.
And so very much like what we were talking about with the county, we're talking about a very fortuitous situation in the short term and some major challenges is still looming ahead.
Yes, these fundamental challenges for the city whereby it's one of its foremost revenue sources is state shared revenue from the state of Wisconsin. That hasn't gone up in years. Hard to know what's going to happen in future budgets. But for now, assuming it doesn't go up, property tax is limited by levy limits and other factors. Meantime, we have these pension and health care pressures and we have infrastructure pressures at the city of Milwaukee as well. We also have the fact that public safety tends to require a much greater investment than other types of services. So this trend of essentially seeing whatever minimal revenue growth the city does see from year to year getting sucked up by police and fire is likely to continue, which leaves fewer dollars for health and public works and potholes and neighborhood services and libraries and so forth.
It is interesting. This is the first year in recent memory I can think of that we are not talking about a major squabble between the county executive and the county sheriff's office.
Yes. So that is another key factor in this year's county budget where, again, you look across the county and you see these fights that have emerged in recent years. And the one with the sheriff has always been the fiercest, essentially a status quo budget for the sheriff this year, which, again, in county budget land, that's good fortune.
Rob Henkin, thanks.
Thank you, Mitch.
Rob Henkin is president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We spoke with him in October, and you can find a link to the forum's briefs on Milwaukee city and county budgets at WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break, then an onstage conversation with poet Andrea Gibson. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Andrea Gibson identifies as a queer spoken word poet, preferring the pronoun they. Gibson's poetry covers a wide spectrum of topics from gender to love to loss, family, and mental health. Their latest book, Lord of the Butterflies, is also about protest.
Following their reading, I sat down with Andrea Gibson on stage at Boswell Book Company and asked about their first experience with spoken word poetry.
I went to a very Catholic college, and by very, I mean my teachers were monks and nuns, and I went there to play basketball. And my team, we were the Lady Monks. That's how Catholic it was. And I was in the closet all through college, and my senior year, I discovered Ani DiFranco, and there was a track that she had spoken word tracks on, you know, in on her albums, and I had never heard it before. And we had to read our favorite poem to graduate in this one nun's class, actually, and I brought her in, and I just played her album, and that's what I did. And and then I discovered Poetry Slam. A few years later, I moved to New Orleans, then I moved to Denver, and I went to the Denver Poetry Slam. And I just fell in love with it immediately because it was, you know, so many feelings all over the place and also feelings in the direction of hoping to change the world for the better. So I loved it.
What is it about writing prose and the poetic form that feeds you as a writer? Had you ever tried doing, say, short stories or essays or anything like that, or was poetry always your clear path?
It was my clear path just because I want something to get done right away. I never had the patience to write anything longer. I've only just recently, I'm working on a memoir right now, and it's sort of my first time diving into anything longer. But with poetry, I just loved how, you could write it, and then it, you know, you didn't have to spend a year writing it. Yeah.
In your poem in this book, Lord of the Butterflies, it's titled, What Do You Think About This Weather? And there's a line that says, your mother used to knit your mittens too big so that you'd kind of grow into them, and that you felt the same way about writing your poems, like they don't fit yet. But now that this is here and tangible in a published book, do you feel that way still? Or is it something that's always constantly changing?
Yeah, well, I just was having such sweet images about my family. You know, when you're, I grew up in a very working class town in rural Maine, and people didn't have a lot of money. So you always, you made your mittens too big so that you could wear them for many years. But I feel that way about poems mostly because I rarely write where I am. I write where I want to be. So my best self is in my poems because I try to write them down and then try to live in that direction. They're sort of like little molds of you know, where I dream to be, especially with hopeful poems or very positive poems. I might be in the most negative space in the world when I'm writing it, and I want to get to a different space or even a more enlightened space. And my poems are wiser than I am by far. I'm a little three-year-old throwing a tantrum a lot of the times. But yeah, I think that this book has been the first book where it's gotten a little bit braver with saying, you know, there's a poem in the book called No Filter where I'm more direct about sucking sometimes. You know, I have this dream of writing a book called Bad Guy, just all about myself, because there's been a way that when you have a platform like this and you're writing about the things that I'm writing about, there's I get lots of comments and stuff of, you're so wonderful. And that's, you know, because you don't see me when I'm in a bad mood and I'm a jerk or something like that. So I want to write a jerk book someday and sell out all my negative qualities.
Well, I think everyone's a jerk most
of
the time.
Yeah, we all are. I mean, that's the thing. We all are. But poets get to present themselves as not a jerk if they want to. And so that's not fair.
So when you're in a bad mood and you're trying to write an uplifting poem, how long does it take you to get in that headspace to get to that, you know, poem of enlightenment or wherever your goal of, I'm here right now, but this poem is going to make me better?
It's usually pretty easy to do because the creative process for me almost always just lifts me into a better space. That's when I'm the happiest. It's when I feel most connected. It's when time just passes like that. I can spend 12 hours in a room writing and it will feel like 10 minutes. I can be on a 5-hour plane ride and can't believe that it's passed so quickly if I'm writing. But yeah, pretty quickly.
Do you prefer to handwrite your poems, or is it mixed depending on what you have at the moment?
I write out loud mostly, I guess, unless I'm on a plane or something. But I write pacing the room, walking around, yelling things, whispering things. If anybody ever walks in on it, it's very awkward. Also, because a lot of the times I don't have the words yet. I just have the sound. I know how I want the poem to sound. And then the words might come later after I know the sound and emotion of the poem. So not only are people walking in on me talking to myself, but they're walking in on me talking to myself and not words. It's something that you really can't pull off with other people around unless you're, I actually can write when I'm walking around the streets of like New York City. Nobody cares. There, yeah.
People might be concerned here. If you
Yeah. Milwaukee, they might stop and
ask, are you
me,
okay?
Yeah. In New York, they don't flinch. Yeah.
Well, that kind of touches upon my next question. So there's a cadence to your performances. But if a reader, say, picks up this book as a novice to poetry and sees the format, there's, you know, your quick definition poems, there's poems that are single space, fill up the whole page. Some go from, you know, margin to margin. Are you writing that for your performance cadence, or is it writing it differently for the reader?
I keep getting asked the question about all the forms in the book because they're more creative than any other book that I've done. And that is almost entirely my girlfriend's doing. She's a poet as well. And what we did is we sort of sat down and I would say the poem to her and she would try to capture it. She knows a lot about form. And so she would try to capture how I say the poem to live on the page and the way that she felt like people would read it the way that I say it. I know virtually nothing about form. I hardly paid attention in school. It's not my craft, really. I come to the page sort of accidentally. I didn't ever plan on doing my first book. A publisher contacted me and said, let's make a book. And at that point, I didn't even have poems on my computer. They were just all in my head. And so I had to just start typing them all out and figure out how to put them on a page.
Is that where you were forced to have poetry and spoken word converge? And where do you think they diverge from each other?
Well, I think what's great about recently is that line is really getting blurred. A lot of really successful, talented spoken word artists are now having a lot of success, you know, getting nominated for the National Book Award and stuff. And so people are showing that they can exist in both spaces and exist powerfully and beautifully. So I think that there's not as much separation as there used to be. I think publishers are more inclined to publish spoken word artists. And I think that line is sort of going away. And I also think that traditional page poets are starting to think, oh, maybe I should learn how to read a poem out loud, you know, because I've gone to see some of my favorite page poets read, and it can be boring. And you want to try to figure out how to make your, you know, move your voice in a way so that you're capturing the emotion of your poem, I think.
Do you feel more comfortable on the printed space since you were mostly spoken word, you're memorizing your poems and, you know, having other people's hands in the formatting of your published books? Do you feel like you're gaining strength in both areas or learning from each one as you put more printed pieces together?
Yeah, I do think. I think that I'm learning about it. We were talking about it earlier. I love, the one thing I love about the page are line breaks, honestly, because that's something that is, you know, I just love reading in books. And so you can't ever capture it, really, when you're performing a poem out loud. Sometimes I want to stop and tell the audience, did you get that line break there? That was a good line break. But you can't do that.
Do you find that certain subjects lend themselves to either spoken word or poetry more than the other? Are there certain subjects you only want to do without a printed book in front of you?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of poems that are political poems, social justice poems that feel like rally cries or protest poems, I often want to just have those memorized, and because it also makes a difference to me to be able to make eye contact with people. That was one of the things that made me fall in love with spoken word from the beginning, is it felt like this conversation, and I don't think the audience ever really knows how much of the poem they're pulling out of a poet, because, you know, you're talking to people, you're seeing their eyes, and you're responding to how other people are responding emotionally. And, you know, it helps when you're in spoken word settings where people are giving a lot of vocal feedback. It helps pull along. But if that's not happening, you want to be able to see people. And when I'm looking at the page, it's hard to do. But just the energy of it, I think energy always just lifts if you're seeing people's eyes.
Where do you think the intersection of poetry and social change meet? Do you think it's a poet's job or anyone of influence to be the people to affect change? Or are you simply recording your experience and it happens to be activism? What is it for you?
I think it's different for everybody. I think in this political climate, it's a radical thing to tell the truth when so many lies are being told. So just the simple act of telling the truth, I think, is political. I also think that creating art and making, even if you're writing about flowers, to put beauty into this world right now, to me, is political and radical, because it's such a destructive culture that it's just, you know, it's going up and battling the destruction to make something lovely. For me, I don't necessarily like writing political poems at all. If I had my way, I'd only write love poems, which queer love poems are political in a way, or in every way. But I just enjoy, I just enjoy writing poems that are hopeful and, not to keep saying the word, but lovely and loving and funny. I enjoy writing that sort of stuff. I don't enjoy writing poems like the one about Orlando. I don't enjoy writing that stuff, but that's where the world is, and that I can't not write it.
We do have a sizable crowd here tonight, and you know, many people would argue that poetry has its fluxes throughout time. You know, we went from, I'm sure, you know, raise of hands, I'm sure a lot of people read like the Iliad, Homer, like epic poetry in high school, and then maybe forgot about it afterwards. But do you feel like prose and poetry are no longer competing as hard, or do you feel like poetry is having a resurgence now?
Whenever people talk about poetry being dead, or I've heard that people aren't buying as many books. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think that's probably true with books of poetry. I feel like poetry is flourishing right now. I think specifically with spoken word and button poetry, and how poetry is reaching so many youth and people who don't think that they like poetry coming to poetry readings. When I first started performing, nobody came to poetry readings except poets. And I wanted that to change so much because, you know, people go, we all go to see bands that we love, even if we're not musicians. So I always wondered, why aren't people who aren't writers coming to hear poetry? And so it was my dream, it still is my dream, that all these, you know, rock clubs around the world get filled up with poets. And I see that happening. I see all these spoken word artists starting to tour rock clubs and music venues, and I think that they should be in that those spaces. And I think it's a testament to just people who don't identify as writers, like falling in love with poetry. And so I from what I witness, I see it growing, and more and more young people getting involved. Some of my favorite poets are 20. Yeah.
Do you think it's both the responsibility of poets and, say, people here in the audience to foster that growth?
I mean, I don't know if you can tell anybody it's a responsibility to love what they love. You know, love what you love. You don't like poetry, like, who cares? but I do think that a lot of people don't know that they love poetry. And so if you love poetry, try to, yeah, let's just say sneak it. Give only poetry as Christmas or holiday, as holiday gifts this year. Yeah.
Well, with poetry, people often come to it the first time as an assignment.
Yeah.
Was that the case for you? I mean, you mentioned you brought in your favorite poet to play for your English teacher, but what are some of your other school experience with either English classes or in being exposed to poetry and deciding like, hey, I think I'll give this a whirl?
I did like it. I remember liking it right away because it was emotional. And I think that I had so many feelings that felt inappropriate. You know how this world makes you feel like feelings are inappropriate when it's basically what makes us. And I remember it being one place where I felt like even if the discussions in the class weren't putting that in the forefront of the conversation, I could feel it. I felt like this is one place where you're given permission or almost expectation to be emotional. And I didn't have that anywhere else in my life. And so I think it was poetry was the first thing that said cry and, you know, feel things.
Award-winning poet Andrea Gibson's latest book is a collection called Lord of the Butterflies. We spoke with them on stage at Boswell Book Company recently, and you can find more of the conversation at WUWM.com.
One more break, then an upcoming Boswell Books guest, Milwaukee area writer Kim Sir, who has a new collection of short fiction. We'll talk with her about it next, plus a riveting interview on the Milwaukee Public Museum's exhibit on a much-loved amphibian. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Listening to Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee-area writer Kim Sir has helped hone the writing skills of many fellow writers in the region as the director of Red Oak Writing. But it's fair to say that students helped shape Sir's own latest project. It's a collection of short fiction called Nothing to Lose, and it's just published by Cornerstone Press, the teaching press of the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point.
That is a story of its own, which we'll hear about in the days to come. But we also talked with Kim Sir about the new book. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
This book takes us to some really pretty dark places. What was the inspiration that that kind of set the entire collection in motion?
Yeah, you know, I try to write light pieces, and somehow they tend to turn dark, and I'm not quite sure what that's all about. Maybe I need to do some therapy to figure that out. But I usually, my stories begin with an image. Or, like, for example, the first story, Night Vision, I was in my parents-in-law's house in Florida, and I looked out the bedroom door, and I had this image of a man standing there with night vision goggles, which for most people would just be unsettling, to say the least. But for me, it was my question was, like, what would he be doing there? And what would happen as a result of that? And so, you know, that's kind of where it started. I didn't set out to write that story. I didn't set out to write a dark story that has a lightness at the end. It's just kind of where it takes me. But I also, too, I like to explore people that I don't understand and try to figure them out and issues that I want to see in a little less black and white terms.
I wondered, actually, as I was reading these stories, whether there is a place for the author as the psychologist of her own characters.
I can't claim that I have those qualifications, but I definitely, I'm glad that you read that I was trying to figure them out and trying to understand them and have compassion for people who are quite different from me.
So some of them seem really to be trying to figure themselves out. I'm trying to make sure I line up the story names with the right stories here. Oh, it was Injustice. I thought that, you know, your main character, and this is another pretty dark story, has an inkling of what's going on, but never quite can connect himself with it.
Right, and he's an adult before he's able to unearth that repressed memory of a childhood trauma. And, you know, I really believe that can happen, and helping him, or I guess following him on his journey to that understanding was part of the fun.
With a collection of stories, do you see a story arc in the entire collection?
You know, I don't set out to write it that way. What I did was I had this mess of stories as a result of my MFA program and some earlier stories that I wrote years and years ago. And I said, all right, how do these things go together? And I had this, I had them on my wall. I had, it ends with a happy note. It ends with a sad note. It's got a male protagonist. It's got a female protagonist. Trying to create that arc. I knew that I wanted to end on a positive note. So I think my most hopeful story is on the back. But I think the front story has its own hopefulness, but it's also, there's some ambiguity there as well.
It's interesting, you know, you hear the sort of cliche that people tell new writers, especially, to write what you know. But if I get what you're doing, you're writing what you don't know.
My book would be so boring if I wrote what I know. Yeah, that's the fun of it for me. I don't know that that's true for all writers, but it's the figuring it out that's the fun part.
What draws you to these? I mean, you know, these are people largely kind of on the fringes of society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think because they get lost. I think our last election might have showed us that, you know, that there's a voice there that maybe isn't always explored, and it's easy to other people. And so I think it's, you know, I don't know. I think it's worth writing about and exploring.
The other thing I mentally noted is, you know, we often think of Wisconsin as being part of flyover country. Right. But this is kind of, at least many of the settings and the people, this is sort of flyover country within flyover country that you're exploring.
Right. And then, you know, when I first wrote the stories, I think I didn't intentionally mask them, but they were neutral, could have happened anywhere kind of stories. And as I re-looked at the collection, I thought, you know what, this is Wisconsin. I might as well just, you know, be transparent about it. And I think that made the stories better. I think it not only highlighted the breadth of people in Wisconsin and communities, and also just I think is a little bit more honest about what the stories are.
Do you get uncomfortable with what goes on in your own stories? And as the author, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I get very uncomfortable because, especially with short stories, because so much is left off the page, there's great possibility of people interpreting what my original intentions were completely the opposite. And I have to be comfortable with that. I have to, you know, recognize that they're going to bring their own lens. And that's actually part of what I love about short stories as a reader and as a writer, is that writer and reader become co-creators of the work. And I just have to, you know, let it go and the stories become ours instead of mine.
Kim Sir is the director of Red Oak Writing and author of the new collection of short fiction called Nothing to Lose. It's published by Cornerstone Press, and we'll have a conversation about that unique resource in the days to come. Sir will read from the new book tomorrow night at Boswell Book Company.
Scientists believe frogs have roamed the Earth for more than 200 million years, and they can be found in nearly every corner of the globe. Frogs hold a vital place in many ecosystems, including those found in Wisconsin.
Dr. Ellen Senske is the interim president and CEO of the Milwaukee Public Museum, which is currently hosting an exhibit all about the life of frogs. Senske spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers earlier this year about the evolution of amphibians and the staggering diversity of these creatures.
There are almost 5,000 species of frogs in the world, and they live in just about every environment and on every continent except Antarctica. So they are pretty much everywhere, and they're fun. They're the things that people aren't afraid of, so it's a great way to get kids interested in nature and biology, is introducing them to frogs, because while some frogs actually do have teeth, most frogs don't have teeth, and so they don't seem to be aggressive and things that kids would be afraid of. So it's just a great way to introduce kids to biology using frogs.
As you mentioned, frogs are amphibians, so they need to be around water. And you also mentioned that they are on really every continent except Antarctica. What are the more far-flung places where you find frogs that people might not realize?
Yeah, most people think frogs live in water and that they are tied directly to water. But actually, frogs can live in very, very dry environments, and they're adapted to that. So I remember when I was doing research down in Paraguay in the Chaco, and the Chaco is a very dry environment where you get rain. There's a rainy season, and the rains come in deluges, and then they're gone. And we were tracking frogs that were in the driest part of the year, up in the tops of trees, you know, in the wind, getting, and you wonder, how do they survive? Well, those frogs, they're called a waxy monkey frog. That frog has a gland on the back of its head, two of them, that secrete a wax-like substance, which they just rub all over their body, and then it seals that moisture in. There are frogs that the eggs are laid up in bromeliads in the tops of trees. There are frogs that are, you know, in relatively dry environments where, again, they come out when it rains. So it might be that they're underground most of the year in hibernation. It rains, they come out, they breed, they go back underground. So they just have adapted to a myriad of ways of life in all different kinds of habitats.
And they've had about 50 million years to do this. They're one of the few animals that really has survived since the time of the dinosaurs.
The dinosaurs, right. They are, and that just goes to show how adaptable they are. And the fact that there are frogs all over the world just shows how the radiation and adaptability of them.
And yet right now we're in a period where frogs are heavily threatened. You know, we talk about endangered animals of all types for all sorts of reasons, but frogs have really, many of the populations of frogs around the world in the last few decades have really been decimated. What are the various things that are impacting frog populations around the world?
Yeah, they're, you know, we kind of think of them as our canary in the mines, in that because they are so intimate with their environment, because they have this skin that absorbs everything, they actually are taking in anything. So if we're putting pesticides into the environment, into the water, they're taking that into their bodies. So the things that are impacting them are land use change, so habitat destruction, and it may be that we take a swamp and we drain it and we put a parking lot on it. Well, that's loss of habitat, and those frogs don't have anywhere to go. So that population ceases to exist. So there's habitat change. There's climate change is impacting frogs because they, again, live in very specific environments. And as those environments change, there may not be a different place for them to move to. They also are impacted by pesticides, by diseases. The latest one that has been impacting frogs is what's called chytrid disease, which is a fungus that has – what it does is it actually embeds in – it's in water. It embeds into their skin, and it actually starts to thicken their skin, and it doesn't allow that exchange of oxygen and electrolytes. And so it actually, as that skin thickens, they actually start to not have the right balance of electrolytes, and their heart stops. So they die. And that has decimated a number of populations. And we don't know a lot about how to prevent that. And it has spread quickly. So I think the biggest thing with frogs is because they're so intimate with their environment, they're giving us a sense of what's going on in the environment that we should be taking note of, because if it gets worse, it may impact humans.
Yeah. As we've lost some of these frogs, both in the United States and throughout the world, what has the impact been like on the ecosystem?
Well, you know, frogs are part of that ecosystem and eat a lot of the insects that we don't like mosquitoes. So the impact is, you know, if you lose one species or one population, you may not see an impact, but that has reverberations both up and down the food chain, and you start to lose more. We don't know how many species do we have to lose in order to all of a sudden have a collapse of an ecosystem, because there is redundancy in the ecosystem where there are other things that perform that function. But that's why it works so well, because that is based on every single – we look at our weather and climate patterns, and every year it's different. And so every year something else is doing better because it's perfect for them, and something else is doing a little worse. And so with that redundancy, you get a system that works. If we start dropping out those redundant species, now all of a sudden we have a system that could collapse suddenly. And I think that's our biggest concern, is that we could be reaching that tipping point where we lose one more and everything falls apart. And we just don't have we can predict that, but we can't predict it precisely.
What are the frog populations like in Wisconsin? What kinds of frogs do we have here?
We have 12 species of frogs here, and most of them are in good shape. Many of them are statewide, so they've got these big distributions, and they're doing well. There are three species, one that's endangered, and which is the cricket frog, and two that are species of special concern. Those frogs likely – their populations, they weren't as widespread, and when you have species that aren't as widespread, when there's an impact on them, you end up – it's not like they're all over the state. So we have – in fact, we have the exhibit frogs, and in that one we have an activity that the museum educators are doing where they will take kids and families and anybody actually through a key to help identify the Wisconsin frogs, and you get to walk away with that key so that when you go out in the woods next summer and you find a frog, you can identify it. You can take it through the key just like a scientist does and identify it.
Figure out what kind of frog you might be.
What kind of frog it is, yes.
Well, Ellen, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Dr. Ellen Senske is the interim president and CEO of the Milwaukee Public Museum. She spoke with Joy Powers in October. The Frogs exhibit is at the museum through early January, and there's more information at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.